If everybody can find a seat. Welcome to our last Midrashat Yom Rishon program. Thank you for being here. Before we start, I just want to thank all of our generous sponsors for the year. We couldn't do this without you, and particularly thank you to Aliza Silverstein, who is sponsoring this year in memory of her sister Miriam Yochanan Basarab Yitzchak. So we are thrilled to welcome Shani Tarragon for, I believe, the third time to our community. Yeah? Okay. So Shani really needs no introduction, but I think I just lost her bio on here. But so Shani has a BA and MA in Tanakh and Talmud from Bar Ilan University. Thank you. All right. She is currently pursuing her PhD in Tanakh while serving as a Ram for Tanakh and Midrashot Lindenbaum. She also teaches adults in multiple other institutions, Matan, Magdalena, Shalavim, and Landers College, as well as the Women's Beit Midrash in Efrat and Ramat Shiloh. She is a graduate of the Yoetz HaHalacha program at Nishmat and serves as a halacha advisor in issues of family purity law. She lectures throughout Eretz Yisrael and internationally and serves on the local religious council dealing with issues of Jewish law and education. Shani and her husband, who we had the privilege of hearing from an hour ago, live on a lunch food with their six children and serve as leaders in their community. Welcome, Shani.
Thank you, Tal, and thank you all for coming here this morning as we prepare appropriately for the 3 weeks, and especially Eloi Neshama for Aliza's sister Be'ezrat Hashem. We now are going to begin with Echa, Sounds of Music. And what's interesting is that we're all very familiar with this Megillah, although a priori, most of the Megillot were not initially written as Megillot, but rather as Svarim. And even though we all hear this on a regular, on an annual basis, most of us don't necessarily give the time nor the thought to truly understanding the various prakim of the Sefer. As I just mentioned, most of these Megillot, which are really Svarim, are meant to be probed, they're meant to be learned, as opposed to a Megillah, which has its name from the fact that it's written as a scroll in order to facilitate reading in a public forum. Right, if you can just imagine something being read as a scroll format, all you'd have to do is unroll it either horizontally, vertically, and you would read this out loud. And the only one of the Megillot that we read now that was written initially as a Megillah was in fact Megillat Esther. And we know this from not only the way that it's written and the way halachically that it must be read in a Megillah form, but also the very fact that by the end of Megillat Esther, we hear that this Patshegen HaKtav, we hear that the actual letter was written aloud and read out loud in the various communities surrounding Shushan HaBira. All the other Sfarim were written in a folio format. That means that they're written one page followed by the other page, and they were meant to be read and meant to be studied as opposed to simply listening as part of an audience. Only once Chazal Institute, the respective readings of these Sfarim on various occasions in public forums, such as Tisha B'Av, only then will they also harness upon themselves the name of Megillah. So let's begin, though, with a little bit of the textual background or the textual context and the historical context of Sefer Echa. Chazal tell us that it's Yirmiyahu who authors Sefer Echa, but actually throughout the Talmud, the terminology that is used for Echa is actually Sefer Kinot. And we're going to note in just a moment how Chazal are very sensitive to the fact that it's really a compilation of various laments, of various poems that are written in a kina format. And we'll speak exactly about what this kina is in just a moment. But first, to understand Yirmiyahu, Yirmiyahu is the same author, Chazal have told us, who also authors Sefer Malachim, part of Nevi'im Rishonim, who also authors Yirmiyahu, his speeches of Nevu'ah, prior to and post the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash. And now we're told that he also authors Sefer HaKinot. What, in fact, is the difference between them? So we know that when it comes to Nevi'im Rishonim and Nevi'im Achronim, both works of Nevuah are inspired by some message of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that's delivered to the prophet in the form of some image, in the form of some divine message of Hashem. And it is up to the prophet to decide how to deliver, how to articulate that message in the most prolific manner possible in order to greatly impact his audience. And therefore, we find two different genres within the works of Nevuah. We find Nevi'im Rishonim, which in fact is not a chronological category, but rather more of a genre. This is going to be historiographical. At times, the Navi writes messages based on what's going on historically in order to share the religious messages that are meant to be extrapolated from the historical events. But he also compiles his own speeches, speeches that at times can also be understood irrespective of the historical background. And these are speeches of Nevuah, very often employing different poetic devices in order to influence his generation, in order to influence specific people whom he chooses to address. Chazal tell us that during the time of Yirmiyahu, there were other Nevi'im who were living, namely Chuldah HaNevi'ah, Tzfaniah HaNevi'ah, and each of them have their own audience based on their different geographical areas. And Yirmiyahu in particular was known also as a Navi HaMelech. Namely, he was the Navi for Yoshiyahu the king, starting the 13th year of Yoshiyahu. After Yoshiyahu begins in his 12th year of religious reform, Yirmiyahu is the Navi who encourages him, continue to do tshuva like Chulda had told you, and this way you'll be successful in deferring somewhat the gzar din, the harsh decree of the destruction of Yerushalayim. We know that Yirmiyahu seems to be successful more or less until the year 612, until the 31st year of Yoshiyahu, wherein then Yoshiyahu goes and after trying to secure the kingdom domestically, is going to go off to internationally try to conquer the fallen Assyrian lands of Mesopotamia. And when he meets Paro Necho in Megiddo, this is when he's killed. His son Yehoahaz, also a nationalist, takes over for 3 months, only to be ousted out by his own brother, Yehoiakim, or Eliakim, who offers to Mitzrayim, to Paro Necho, the opportunity for an alliance, in which case Paro Necho allows Yehoiakim to take over as king. Yehoiakim, through this political alliance, is also going to organize a cultural, religious alliance with Mitzrayim, adopting Egyptian culture and idolatry, transforming the Beit HaMikdash once again into a pagan center, as his great-grandfather Menashe had done. And Yirmiyahu continues to enforce and to spread his messages, as we find in Sefer Yirmiyahu, to Yehoiakim for 4 years, until the fatal year of 605, known as the year of the beginning of the loss of autonomy, also known as the beginning of the years of Galut. For the next 70 years, Am Yisrael finds itself under the autonomy of the Babylonian peoples. This, as we know, is not only the beginning of the Galut, but only 18 years later, we're going to suffer the Churban. And this basically is what we find in Sefer Yirmiyahu. The speeches of Yirmiyahu, primarily for the first 4 years of Yehoiakim, trying to influence Yehoiakim, trying to, again, push off the Gzar Din as much as he can. And then as soon as the Babylonians under Nebuchadnezzar come in to control the lands of Israel, already trying to tell them of their fatal aftermath. And then we turn to Eicha, and we're wondering why a need for another Sefer, and if so, what do we already know is the difference within the Tanakh context of Eicha versus Yirmiyahu and versus Sefer Melachim? Eicha is part of the Ketuvim, not one of the Sefrei Nevuah. And Chazal already tell us that the words and works of the Ketuvim are inspired by Ruach HaKodesh. These are not direct messages of God to a person through Nevuah, but rather these are divinely inspired. Inspiring, as the Rambam tells us, the talents of the person, the ideas of the person, to be able to express in his own words different thoughts, different emotions, sometimes different philosophies that he wants to share with an audience. And it helps then to understand that when we look at Sefer Eicha, we appreciate a different genre. This is not going to be based on messages of God, but rather, these are Yirmiyahu's personal words. Or from now on, we're going to say the words of the Mekonein, the lamenter. He wants to share something with us. And as soon as we open up Sefer Eicha, we already note a very interesting genre, and that is that of poetry. We note the imagery, the personification, the various meter and rhythm that exists within Eicha, and we ask ourselves why, out of all the genre out there, and especially after hearing the narrative of Sefer Melachim, and hearing some poetic forms in Sefer Yirmiyahu, why now does the Mekonein charge us with the various poetic expression. Why is he going to discuss what occurs after the Churban Beit HaMikdash? Why with poetry? And with this, we have to recall that poetry, as defined in any dictionary, poetry is going to allow for the freedom of language. Poetry allows for greater expression, not merely for the poet to express emotions, but all the more so in order to elicit emotions from the reader, in order to evoke a very specific emotional response from his audience. And that's obviously the challenge of Eicha. So much so, the Chazal explained to us that Sefer Eicha, because ultimately Chazal will call it a Megillah once we read it out loud on Tisha B'Av, so Chazal say maybe this is in fact the Megillah Sefer, a Megillah, something that's read aloud in a public forum, but also a Sefer, something that is longer, that is meant to be studied. Maybe this is the Megillat Sefer that we hear about in Yirmiyahu Perek Lamed Vav, in the fourth year of Yehoyakim, when Yehoyakim, who at that point has already placed Yirmiyahu under house arrest, who won't allow Yirmiyahu to deliver public prophecies, Yirmiyahu is going to command his scribe, his apprentice, Baruch ben Neriah, to go up at a time of a fast. We know that there are various famines during this time, year after year of Batsoret, a succession of droughts, and therefore by Kislev, when the country sees that they're not receiving sufficient rainfall, a fast is declared on Har HaBayit, and Baruch reads a Megillat Sefer, which apparently, if we look in Yirmiyahu Perek Lamed Vav, is a concise format of 22 years worth of Nevuah of Yirmiyahu to the people. And he basically is telling them, this is your last chance. I'm telling you, Nebuchadnezzar is on his way down here. He's debating whether or not to start conquering the trade routes that lead to Egypt. He's debating whether to go through Jerusalem, to go through basically the Mediterranean coast, or to go through what we call today the area of the Transjordan. And by now, we find that he's decided to go through Jerusalem to conquer the Mediterranean trade routes. And therefore, Yirmiyahu says, listen to everything that I've been telling you for the past 4 years. And you've already seen how the agriculture has suffered, how your political power has waned. Chazal tell us, maybe that's when he compiled Sefer Eicha. Maybe through his very poignant poetic expression, he was trying to enforce to the people what would happen not only during the time of destruction, but ultimately in the aftermath. Now, this is a beautiful conservation of text that Chazal are attempting to portray to us, but we know, and for all those who have opened up Sefer Eicha, the poetry, the expressions, are so depictive. They are so, I would say, exacting in the illustration of the Churban that it's very difficult to believe that 18 years prior to the destruction, that Yirmiyahu could have articulated himself in such an exact manner, in such a powerful, through powerful illustration and imagery. And therefore, our understanding is that, in fact, he compiled Sefer Eicha, Sefer Keynotes, as individual keynotes that he ended up, or Chazal, canonized together. But this is all post-Churban. Yirmiyahu in Sefer Eicha is no longer warning the people of the impending disaster, but rather is trying to relate to the status quo, is relating to the people after their first national disaster, after the first national genocide that even today we see only parallel to the Holocaust of the past century, that this is what Yirmiyahu has to deal with. How, as a people, are we going to pick ourselves up and deal post-national disaster, post the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash? And this is really his goal. His goal is to try to help a people who have now incurred the worst phenomenon of their lives on the national level, and to try to help them pick up the pieces and move on. Let's see how he does this. He does this, as I mentioned, through poetry, in order to elicit a response, because the people can't pick themselves up unless they begin to respond to the reality, unless they understand the situation that has befallen them. And therefore, if we look at Sefer Eicha, we note now, from a very textual perspective, that not only is the poetry going to share with us certain emotions of Yirmiyahu himself, of the Mekonein, but in order to elicit responses from us, is going to employ various poetic devices. We begin with the broadest one, namely the structure. For all those who are familiar with the first perek, Professor Gabi Cohen has already pointed out the most universal structure that we find in Tanakh, namely, anyone know? Chiastic structure, chiastic from the Greek word chias, meaning an X, an ABBA structure. showing, again, a certain inclusio format, showing us that everything with which he started is going to come around, almost giving us a certain sense, ironically, of closure to the situation. But as we open up Sefer Eicha, we note an altogether different structure, a structure that doesn't appear as often in Tanakh, and here, as you see on the source material, the structure of the acrostic, the alphabet structure. If we look at Kina Aleph, again, which we know based on the Christian division, Perek Aleph, again, we see Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, He, all the way through Taf, the 22 psukim. It's true that the Ayin and the Pei, you'll notice that in the first two keynotes, the Pei precedes the Ayin, only to prove to us what has now been found in Megillot Midbarei Yehuda, that this is still the beginnings of the stages of the formation of the ancient Hebrew alphabet, where at times letters can switch, that we find at times, in fact, Peis before the Ayins, just like we know that the original phonetic identities of the letters are going to be changed throughout the years. Just as a popular example, the Sin and the Samach, each of them originally had its own phonetic identities. Only throughout the ages, we already see during the time of Yiftach, that the Sin and the Shin cannot be pronounced by everybody, and ultimately, again, the Sin will become, instead of an S-T-H sound, will become merely that S sounds of the Samach. So too, again, the alphabet is still undergoing various transitions, and yet we find a 22-letter Aleph Bet that is going to be consistent in Kinot Aleph through Dalid. Aleph Bet Gimel and Kina Dalid all share this acrostic form, on one hand telling us that every Kina stands alone. We have Aleph through Taf, and again Aleph through Taf. Note that by the third Kina we have what's known as a triple acrostic. Aleph, 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 Bet, Bet, Bet. Almost as if the Meconium is trying to tell us, I tried in the first Kina to have an effect on you, and I tried again in the second Kina. By the third, our impression is, and certainly the emotional response should be, let's try this thrice time. Let's try this again in a much more aggressive manner. By the third time, he's going to say, I'm going to attempt in a triple acrostic to try to share my message with you. But what, in fact, is the message of the acrostic? Why does one choose, whether it's Mizmor Kuf Mem Hei in Sefer Tehillim, whether it's Mishlei Lamed Aleph, whether it's the seven-time acrostic in Mizmor Kuf Yutet in Sefer Tehillim, whether it's the various piyutim that you're all familiar with in our liturgy? Why is it that someone would use the acrostic? So on one hand, if we take, for example, Father's Day, right? And I want to say, again, Happy Father's Day, Dad, right? You are dynamite. You are amazing. You are, another D, anyone? You are dear to me. Excellent. Beautiful. Again, so note that just by taking these three letters, I've encompassed my expressions towards my father. And this is exactly what Chazal tell us, that on one hand, the acrostic allows for a comprehensive nature, for an all-inclusive nature. The Midrash Rabbah in Eicha, the first source that you see, tells us, in fact, in the negative, that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu punished Am Yisrael based on Sefer Yirmiyahu, V'yasafti liyosra etchem, sheva al chatotechem, I am going to punish you sevenfold for your iniquities. Atem avartem lefanai sheva avirot. You have transgressed seven sins before me. Bo'u v'kiblo alechem sheva poraniyot. For that midah keneged midah, you're going to receive seven punishments. Atem avartem lefanai sheva avirot. And not only are you going to be punished sevenfold, but because of these seven transgressions, Hare Yirmiyahu ba mikonein alechem kinot shehu sheva alfabetin echa. Yirmiyahu is also going to lament for your seven sins. He's going to lament in an all-comprehensive nature. He's going to share with you what has transpired in seven various keynotes of the alphabet. Similarly, the Midrash Tatsheh shares with us that why is it that Yirmiyahu chose the acrostic form, Lama nechtav kol ha-sefer hazeh, k'seder chaf bet otiyot sheba alphabet, v'shvil sheya ha-sefer hazeh muchan v'ragil l'chol Yisrael b'fihem. And indeed, biblical scholars maintain that whenever we find a chapter, especially something that was sung, for example, in Sefer Tehillim, the various mizmorim, the psalms that were recited around the Avodat Beit HaMikdash, whenever you find a song like this written in the acrostic form, biblical scholars maintain that this was used as a primer. It was meant to teach the young children the alphabet, very similar to our various phonics workshops that we have today. A is for apple, B is for bat, whatever the case may be. And it must be Tilala David Aromimcha Lokai HaMelech. This is how young children were taught the letters of the alphabet. That all sounds very nice until we get to Echa. It's very difficult to imagine that a tutor would try to teach the letters of the alphabet through this very distressing work of Echa. Nonetheless, Chazal maintained, maybe it was so that even young children would know these by heart. Again, we all learn, whether it's Anim Zmirot or Eshet Chayil at a young age, because it's very easy to memorize because we're familiar with the order of the alphabet. Mukhan v'ragil, maybe not necessarily to train the young children, but to ensure that everyone would have accessibility and ease, again, not more as a form of a mnemonic. Ba'u kol hadorot v'chol ha'otiyot v'chol ha'briyot sheba'olam. And yet Chazal offer, recognizing that maybe Echa is not the paradigm of something that we want to be mukhan v'ragil b'fihim, in everyone's mouths, they say, but ultimately, what is the point of the acrostic? To show the most comprehensive nature. Just as Chazal used this terminology, for example, by the Avot, when they say that the Avot observe the mitzvot mi alef ataf. We know that there aren't mitzvot, literally, mi alef ataf, other than Rav Sadia Gaon, who in his Sefer HaMitzvot actually does, in a rhyming format, he lists all the mitzvot under the letters of the alphabet. But we know that there are some that don't necessarily fit into all the letters of the alphabet. Nonetheless, again, this is used to show that the Avot kept all the mitzvot of the Torah, a comprehensive nature. So too, all the generations, all the letters, all the creations of the world, Elyonim v'tachtonim, the celestial and the mortal ones, v'amdu al hatzarot v'al hara'ot shehigyu liYisrael. They came to protest, they came to serve as witnesses for all that has transpired. Maybe this is why the Mekonein chooses the letters of the alphabet. Maybe he's trying to say, we have just experienced the worst national catastrophe of our lives. How am I going to depict this to the people? How am I going to show them the comprehensive, all-inclusive nature of this disaster? I am going to write it in the letters of the alphabet. But as you know, one of the shortcomings of the acrostic, for example, if we go back to our Father's Day card, I can say that my father is dynamic, I can say that he's dynamite, I can say that he's dear to me, and he's amazing and astounding, but I can't say that he's a wonderful doctor. Oh, actually, there is a D. But I can say that he, again, is a great ball player, because there's no B and there's no P there. So I find myself somewhat limited. And this is a question that obviously arises. As soon as the poet decides on the employments of the acrostic, is he limiting his expression? Well, for those who are familiar, not only with Mizmor Kuf Mem Hei, as we recited this morning, when one says Tehillah LeDavid, do you find that the praises of HaKadosh Baruch Hu are limited? Very difficult to see it that way. So too, if I open up Echa, I note that not only do I not feel that he's limited, but if anything, he seems to even employ the alliteration. Sometimes within the psukim, he'll even add extra letters with that same name, showing us that he's not attempting to break out of the acrostic, but rather he prefers to stay within this somewhat limited structure. But at the same time, we don't feel the limitations. We don't feel any shortcomings of expression. Nonetheless, perhaps what he is trying to tell us is that he's living during chaotic times, and he specifically is going to employ the acrostic in order to place some structure in his life. And when we think of structure, what comes to mind? Surely the alphabet. Each one of these letters representing, on one hand, limitless expressions, but at the same time, I have to maintain that phonetic symbol. And maybe what he's trying to tell us is that he needs this limitation. He needs this universal structure in order to place some organization to his life. With this, we're more or less ready to begin. Now we understand that every kina stands alone. For after all, every kina, every lament, is going to have its own alphabet structure through Perek Dalet. All of a sudden, we turn to Perek He. Perek He begins with Zachor Hashem, begins with the Zion. We continue and we find that there isn't an alphabet structure, and therefore many biblical scholars maintain that the fifth kina was added later on, was not part of the original formulation of the kinot of the Mekonein post the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. However, the very sensitive reader will note that how many psukim are there in Perek He? There are exactly 22. telling us that it probably is the same Mekonein, it is the same author, who wants to tell us that there is a shift in his expression. And as soon as you turn to the very first pasuk of Perek Hei, you note that he's no longer addressing the people, but who does he turn to? Zachor Hashem mehayalanu. His audience has shifted. It is no longer his audience of the survivors of the Holocaust. It is no longer the audience of those that have suffered through the Chorban Beit HaMikdash. But now he turns directly to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and demands an audience with God. And that's why he shifts the structure to tell us that there is a shift in his entire perspective. But at the same time, he is going to maintain the 22-letter expression, the 22 psukim, in order to show us that this is a natural continuation of the keynote that he has shared with us until this time. Another clear device that we find is that even though every kina stands alone, and for all we know, maybe he composed more keynote that weren't canonized in the Tanakh. Nonetheless, it's clear that these keynote belong together, because other than the last one, how do they each begin? They begin with the term Echa. And this is why Chazal, in the end, although they initially call the Sefer Sefer HaKinot, by the time that it's read as a Megillah, we note another common denominator. Now that it's going to be read as an entire reading together, we're not going to see them merely as individual keynotes, as individual laments, but rather as an all-inclusive Sefer that share within every kina this opening word of Echa. And it's clear, if we speak about poetic devices, that Echa, which means, what is the vernacular of Echa? Echa really means Ech, right? How did this happen? But as soon as it's expressed in the Kamatz Hei, with the added snu'ah, with the added vowel of Echa, we're supposed to hear a certain woe, a certain sigh. Again, this is clearly part of the rhythm within the kina itself. And this is the kina rhythm that has basically been accepted throughout all the biblical prakima, where we find this type of rhyme and meter, not only the extra vowel sound, but ultimately, again, what is known as the long meter followed by the short meter. We're going to see, for example, Echa Yeshva Badad, Ha'ir Rabati Am, going from usually 4 syllables to 3 or to 2 syllables, almost as if we're a little disappointed by the time we get to the ending clauses. We're hoping for some type of parallel structure, but we have lessened the amount of symbols, of syllables. We have lessened the sounds that are here, almost as if the author, the lamenter, the poet, wants to tell us you should feel a little bit of anticipation, followed by disappointment. Let's take a look then at this word, Echa. We know that the Shabbat before Tisha B'Av, known as Shabbat Chazon, we read, interestingly, always Sefer Dvarim, the first time in Tanakh that we find this word Echa. And even though Chazal tried to tell us that in Sefer Bereshit, immediately after the sin of Adam HaRishon, we find a very similar word, namely Ayeka, beautiful, which literally means, where are you? Not Echa, not how did this happen? But noting that same lament sounds of Ayeka, Hashem could have just said, Eifo Ata, but there is a lament. There is a certain fall from the ideal of Adam and Chava at that time. But let's continue with Dvarim. Let us see, what does this word depict? Is it really just the same word of Echa? How did this happen? Mentioned with the extra vowel, so that we'll feel a certain poetic expression, almost as if there's an accompanying sigh. But we find that it expresses something else. Every time that Echa is employed in Tanakh, it is used as an expression of agony, and specifically an agony of abandonment, or a certain loneliness that is felt. As Rav Soloveitchik often speaks about the existential loneliness of man, that even though man can be surrounded by many people, he ultimately feels abandoned. He feels that he's experiencing something completely alone. This is exactly what Moshe Rabbeinu expresses when he records how he felt carrying the burdens of the people, the legal burdens of the people, the social issues with which they'd come to him. Echa esa levadi torchechem masechem derivchem. How could I, not simply how could I judge you, how could I deal with all of your issues, but how can I do this alone? He feels literally alone. He feels abandoned by all those who could help him, and he says, who's the one who actually came to his aid? Again, we know the story, Yitro. He explains that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, now's the time for you to encourage other people to help you with your functions, Moshe. Now's the time for Sarei Alafim, Sarei Meot. So too in Sefer Tzvarim Perek Zayin, Moshe addresses the people and tells them, upon their imminent entrance to the land of Israel, Ki tomar bilvavcha, he recognizes that they may come into the land and they will say, Rabim ha-goyim ha-ele. The goyim are the majority. The other nations, they rule. Echa ucha la-ha-urisham. What are the people going to be afraid of? Echa. That they're alone, that they're in the minority. How could they possibly inherit this land, overpower the nations that are there? Similarly, in Zvarim Perek Yud Bet, the people may say, Echa yovdu ha-goyim ha-ele et Eloheim ve-sechem gamani. What we generally call negative peer pressure. The people are going to feel, we have this strange worshipping of the Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei God, but look at all the other nations. They're doing something else. They're worshipping in different ways, and they're worshipping different gods. Maybe, instead of being alone, maybe we should join them. Echa yovdu ha-goyim ha-ele. Why should we do something so different than they? And in Zvarim Perek Yud-Chet, a similar feeling that may come about when one is going to be to hear words of nevuat sheker, one is also going to feel, I'm all alone, I don't know, has God really said these words or not? But perhaps the greatest expression is really in Shirat HaZinu, when Moshe warns them of what will happen when they do worship Avodah Zarah. He tells them one of the punishments, Echa yirdof echad elef. Ushnayim yanisu rivava. What a terrible feeling it's going to be when one runs after a thousand, when that one is going to feel abandoned and alone. And with this, we continue in Yeshayahu, the Haftarah that we read, Shabbat Chazon. Echa haita lizona kirya nemana. What happened to Yerushalayim? That now, instead of being a city of credibility, a trustworthy place, the same city, mileti mishpat tzedek yalinba. And what is Yerushalayim now? Now she's a zona. Now she's a prostitute. Now she stands all alone on the fringes of society. Again, a cry, a woe of abandonment. Yirmiyahu uses the same term in Perekhet. Echat amru chachamim anachnu v'torat Hashem itanu. You think that God is with you, but ultimately he's not. Achim hinei la sheker. Yirmiyahu perek memchet. Echa nishpor mateh az. How are we, again, as the minority, all alone, how are we going to be able to somehow ward off the much stronger Babylonian government that has taken over Yerushalayim? And I quote now specifically from Ketuvim as well, for you to appreciate the comprehensive terminology of Echa, even in Shir HaShirim, even in poetics, we find that this term Echa is used, for example, the very beginning of Shir HaShirim, when the female persona wants to offer to meet with the male, with her beloved. What does she ask him? Hagida li shava nafshi, Echa tir'eh, Echa tarbit b'tzaharayim. She is begging him, where will you go, Echa? Where will you go alone? I don't want to go out and meet you as a shepherd with all of your shepherd friends. Shelama eye ko'otia ala drecha ve'recha. Why should I look like a prostitute amongst your various friends? In other words, she is asking for a one-on-one date. I don't want to go out with all your shepherd friends. Echa. Tell me when you will be alone. Again, the cry of loneliness, the cry of that existential loneliness and abandonment. And we're going to see this now enforced in each one of the keynotes, but I'd like to, over the course of the remainder of the shiur, particularly focus on Echa Perek Aleph, known as the Kina Rishona, for us to get a little bit of a sense of what the goal of the Mekonein is, sharing poetry in order to elicit some type of an emotional response from the reader. And as we approach Tisha B'Av over the next 3 weeks, we have to ask ourselves, how are we supposed to respond? Chazal have told us numerous times that every generation in which the Beit HaMikdash is not rebuilt means that we are just as guilty. So let's turn back to the generation of over 2,000 years ago, of 2,500 years ago, and let's try to understand what they didn't respond to, so that maybe we'll be a little bit more attuned to the message here, not only of the prophet, but ultimately of the poets. We begin then with Echa Perek Aleph. I'm going to ask you over the course of the next few minutes, as one does in any poetry reading, just to listen. To listen and laha'azin l'divrei hakatuv, simply to be sensitive to the words, to be sensitive to the poetic devices, to try to see what emotional strings the poet is attempting to pull. Echa yashva badad ha'ir rabati am, hayta ka'almana rabati bagoyim, sarati bamdinot hayta lamas. You should already feel the kina rhythm of the longer followed by the shorter. Bachol tifke balayla v'demata alechiyad ein la menachem mikol oaveha kol re'eha bagduba hayu la lo'oivim galta yehuda me'oni umirov avoda hiyashva v'goyim lo matza manoach kol rotfeha hisiguha bein hamitzarim darchei tzion avelot mibli ba'im oed kol sha'reha shomimin kol hanen nanachim betuloteha nugot v'him marla hayu tzareha l'rosh oiveha shalu ki Hashem hu ga'al rob sha'eha olalaha ochushvi lefnei tzar vayetzei mibat tzion kol hadara hayu sareha kayalim lo matzu mir'e vayelchu b'lo choach lefnei rodif zachra yushalayim mimei onya umrudeha kol machmudeha asher hayu mimei kedem v'nfol ama b'yad tzar ve'en ozer la ro'u atzarim sachaku al nishbataha chayt chata yushalayim al kein lenida hayata kol mechabda hiziloa ki ra'u ervata gam hi nanacha v'atasha v'chor tumata b'shulaha lo zachra acharita v'teret plaim en menachem la re'ei Hashem etzoni ki higdil oyev yado parasar kol mechamada ki rata goyim ba'u mikdasha asher tzivita lo yavo b'kahalach kol aman nanachim mevakshim lechem natnu mechamadehem ba'ochel la'ashif nefesh re'ei Hashem v'habita ki hayiti zolila lo alechem kol ovrei derech habitu ru'u im yesh machov kemachovi asher olali asher hoga Hashem v'yom charon apo nimarom shalach ish bat motai v'yirdena paras reshet l'raglai heshivani achor netanani shomima kol hayom dava niskar ob sha'ai biyado yistargu alu al tzavari hechshil kochi netanani adonai bidei lo uchalkum Sila kol abirai adonai bekerbi kara alai moed lishvor bachurai gat darach adonai lebtulat bat Yehuda al ele ani bochia eni yorda mayim ki rachak mimeni menachem mishiv nafshi hayu vanai shomimim ki gavar oyev persat ziyon biyadaha en menachem la tziva Hashem liakov svivav tzarav hayta Yerushalayim nida binehen Tzadiku Hashem kipiu mariti. Shimuna kol ha'amim uru'um machovi. Betulotai bachurai halchu bashevi. Karati lema'ovai hema rimuni. Kohanai uzkenai ba'ir gava'u. Ki bikshu ochel lamo v'yashivu et nafsham. Re'e Hashem kitzar li. Me'ay chamarmaru. Ne'apach libi bikirbi ki marom mariti. V'ichud shekla cherev babayit kamavet. Shemu ken anacha ani. En menachem li. Kol oivai shamu ra'ati sasu, ke'ata sita, hevet ayom, karata, ve'yu kamoni. Tavol kol ra'atam lefanecha va'ol alamo, kasher olat ali achob sha'ai, ki rabot anchotai v'libi davai. And in any poetry session, one has to ask, immediately after being attentive to the various poetic devices and the sounds and the rhythm and the meter, what did you feel? Did anyone hear any particular sounds, any motifs that repeated themselves? Any perhaps strings that were pulled inside of you? Any sounds that you found, perhaps alliterated time and time again? So I guess it's time to go back to the very beginning. And here you see, I tried to help just a little bit by bolding the leitmotif, the bitoy manche, the repetitive phrase. What is the repetitive phrase in this kina? Ein menachem. There is no one to comfort. Notice that more than anything else that's bothering the mekonein right now is that Yerushalayim is sitting in mourning. She is sitting in Anna, sitting in Avelut, and no one is coming to pay a shiva call. Note that more than the destruction that's described, more than the feelings even of the fact that she deserves what Hashem has given her, she deserves the wrath of God because of her various iniquities, what is bothering her more than anything else? Ein menachem, that no one is coming to comfort, no one is coming to pay a shiva call. And why is this so terrible? Well, Chazal help us understand this. If you turn over to the next page, Chazal tried to help us appreciate this by recognizing that ultimately, when it comes to paying a shiva call, this mitzvah, ena mesachek tuvot, is told to us as one of two mitzvot for which we're required, Tanu Rabbanan Mevatlin Talmud Torah. You're supposed to stop learning Torah. Can you imagine this? There are two mitzvot for which you drop everything. You stop your learning in the Beit Midrash. Lo Tza'at Hamit, which mitzvah is that? Not only the actual burial of the dead, but Chazal explained to us, included within this is Nichum Avilim and Haknasat Kala, which again means not only preparing for the wedding, but under the mitzvah of Haknasat Kala is also the mitzvah of Simchat Kala. No, by the way, the mitzvah is not Simchat Chatan V'Kala. Apparently, who needs the happiness? The Kala. We'll get back to this in just a minute, but Amu Alav al Rabbi Yehuda, the Rabbi Laisha Yam Vatel Talmud Torah. Just in case you're wondering, did this really happen? Even though Chazal say this, is this a mere suggestion or is this actual halacha? Look at Rabbi Yehuda Bar Ilai. He would get up from the Beit Midrash, Lo Tza'at Hametu Lachnasat Kala. Now, do you mind if I ask you? Let's start with the happy one, the Hachnasat Kala. I know, Anna, this afternoon, my husband and I are going to attend a wedding, Be'ezrat Hashem. There are over 650 people invited to this wedding. Do you really think that they're going to notice whether or not we come?
Sure.
Okay, that's very nice and complimentary. Thank you. But chances are, again, probably not. And yet, Chazal tell me that I have a mitzvah. I can't continue teaching a Midrashit Yom Rishon because I have to go to this wedding. Gana, I have a mitzvah of Simchat Kala. Now why? What's so important about making that Kala happy? So she doesn't even necessarily know who I am. In this case she does, but very often I'll accompany my husband to a Talmud's wedding. I don't know if the Kala necessarily knows who I am, and yet there still is a mitzvah of Simchat Kala. So I'm sure you've seen at certain weddings, Rabbanim who even go over to the Kala side, and what do? They dance in front of the Kala because that really is the mitzvah. They're not there to eat the filet mignon. They're there for the dancing, to make the Kala happy. Why does the Kala have to be happy on her wedding day? Isn't she naturally happy? So let's go back, again, many of us, just a couple of years. And most Kalot, in addition to the excitement of the wedding day, what do many brides feel at the same time? They're excited, but they're also anxious. And they're nervous. What are they nervous about? They love their chatan, and yet, what are they wondering? And interestingly, psychologists speak about this phenomenon as much more common to the kalot, to brides, than to grooms. I'm not talking about the initial stages of dating, but once they're ready to get married, the groom is excited, he wants to marry the kala. The kala is also excited, don't get me wrong, but she's wondering till the last minute, is this the right boy for me? Right? That is some thought that she has in the back of her mind. Right? Some of you are looking in and nodding, and others are looking and saying, no, right? I knew all along. Whatever the case is, even if you know, when someone dances with you, what sense does the kala, does the bride now receive? By dancing with the kala, what message am I delivering to her? I am assuring her. I am confirming her choice. I am telling her that even though last week I told you that you may be making a mistake, again, the fact that I am at your wedding right now dancing with you means that I am confirming your decision. I am affirming it. I am part of society, and each member, even guest number 651, each one is there to say, I am happy for your choice. Does that have an effect on the simcha of the kala? Definitely. I represent part of society, and I am coming to basically include her and tell her I am giving you the strength to go and to build a beautiful home in Am Yisrael. Now we turn to the Nichum Avilim. Even if I just go and I sit there at an Avil's house and I don't say anything, and there's so many people there in the Shiva house that I can't even get up to say HaMakom Yenachim Utcha B'toch Shavalei Tziyon V'Yerushalayim, I nonetheless have fulfilled the mitzvah of Nichum Avilim. But what did I really do? What I did is I sat there in front of an avil, who Rav Soloveitchik portrays this beautifully, who is someone who feels that they are now part of the life, or I would say ironically, they're part of the dead. They have just seen someone beloved to them be buried in the ground. I'm sure some of you have at times experienced where the relative wants to literally throw themselves into the grave because they feel connected more with the dead one than they do with the will to go on living. And as part of society, I come to sit there, l'nachem et ha'avil, to tell the avil that you are part of the living, that I just stopped in between my three carpels to tell you that next week you're going to be doing carpel again, to show you that you are really part of this world, you are part of our society. And as hurtful and painful as it is to lose someone that you have loved, to feel more connected to death right now, I am here to affirm your connection to life and to the living. And that's why it's so significant. You have to stop Talmud Torah, because you, in fact, are infusing that avil with a will to live. That being the case, if Yerushalayim is sitting right now, and she's mourning over the fact that she's in avilut, she is mourning, but no one is coming, l'nachem ota, what is she basically expressing to us? No one is giving her a will to live and to move on. She has no reason to continue to get up and to pick up the pieces of her life. No one is telling her, go up to Harabaya, because there's no Beit HaMikdash now. And once upon a time, the minhag was that on day 3 and 7 of one's avilut, one would go up to the Beit HaMikdash, and instead of entering the Beit HaMikdash counterclockwise, you would enter clockwise, so that anyone who would meet you along the way, what would they wish you? Hamako, may this place offer you comfort amongst all those who are experiencing trouble and mourning in Yerushalayim. And Yerushalayim doesn't have that anymore. She has no one who's telling her that it's okay. There's life thereafter. You can pick up and move on. And with this, we then turn to another form of poetry. In addition to this motif, if we turn back to the beginning, we recognize that what other device is the poet? Is Yirmiyahu lamenting? What else does he employ here? Note that back to Pasuk Aleph, Echa yashva badar ha'ir rabati am. Look at the city. How? How in the form of a lament you're supposed to hear the sigh, the woe of abandonment, the agony in the voice. How could she sit here? The city that was once Rabati Bogoyim Sarati Bamdinot, that was considered the jewel, the apple of the eye of everyone going through the city, that was a very populated city. How can she sit here now, all alone? Badad Haitaka Almana, as a widow. What is he clearly doing? He is employing the device known as personification. He is personifying the inanimate city as if she is a glorious female who has lost her grandeur. And the question is why? If in fact he's trying to address the audience, then why doesn't he speak directly to the audience and tell them, you are all alone, you feel abandoned. You feel abandoned, by the way, interestingly, not by God, but what is the feeling of abandonment that's expressed? You're abandoned by whom? By your lovers, right? Notice that she thinks that her allies, namely Mitzrayim, as we mentioned in the beginning, in the historical context, Mitzrayim should have helped her, and yet she's all alone. And she can't understand, I thought they love me, or at least they're my friends. Only by the very end of the Kina will she recognize, oh my, they have transformed into my enemies by not only seeing me in my state of agony, but not even coming to offer any assistance, and ultimately mocking me. And this is our sense of the city itself depicting the cries of the people. But again, why personify the city if he really wants to address the people and he wants to tell the people, this is the situation that you're in? When we know that anyone who's experienced any tragedy, psychologists have told us that there are 5 steps of dealing with any tragedy. The first stage is known as the stage of shock and denial. That one is in such a state that one denies it. So if the poet would come and say, this is the situation that you're in right now, how would the people respond? Oh no, that's not us. And therefore, what does he say? He says, okay, don't look at yourselves. I want you to picture Yerushalayim. And maybe you'll be able to relate to her. And you'll be able to understand that this is what you're going through right now. Imagine, and we know that this truly happens, post the Holocaust, post the Shoah, imagine everyone gathering in an auditorium. And the MC gets up to tell everyone, okay, let's start dealing with what we've all gone through. And he starts to tell them about the horrors of the camps. And they themselves have experienced this. As a matter of fact, they're sitting in the auditorium still with their prisoner uniforms on them. Are they going to be able to absorb, to internalize what has transpired? No. So instead, what does the Mekonein say? The Mekonein says, okay, I'd like to show you Mrs. Goldberg. Mrs. Goldberg here, and she has undergone terrible tragedies. Well, let me tell you about Mrs. Goldberg. She lived in Warsaw pre-war, and you probably all remember her. She was a beautiful blonde. She always walked around with elegant clothing. And she was a tremendous philanthropist, a very cultured woman. But I have to warn you, because now you're going to see that she's abandoned, she's wrinkled, she's tattered. She has a number tattooed on her arm. And as she looks completely disheveled, she no longer has her hair but mere stubble that's left over the scars on her head. And hopefully the people will begin to relate to this form, to this image that they have before them. We know that American soldiers who liberated Auschwitz-Birkenau and Bergen-Belsen tell of some of the stories of the prisoners and their responses immediately upon liberation. Again, we know that many of them, unfortunately, asked for what they knew American soldiers would have, such as chocolate bars, and unfortunately devoured them a little too quickly. But another strange request that these soldiers say they were asked of was to look at a mirror. Why did some of the liberated prisoners want to look at a mirror? They hadn't seen themselves, some of them, in 2, 3, 4 years. And then they describe a very interesting phenomenon, that some of these prisoners would take a mirror, and what would happen? They would literally go insane. Some fainted on the spot. And you have to wonder, why are they so shocked? They can't imagine their emaciated faces. They don't know their skeletal bones. They don't see their shaven heads. After all, their comrades are right next to them. They see their peers who have transformed into skeletal beings before their very eyes. They don't think that they look this way either. But we know psychologically, and this is very much related to self-image, we know, for example, I have a picture of myself before me based on the way that I looked in the mirror, and now about 4 hours ago. And now, why is this? That's the picture that I have. For all I know, I don't know, I have chocolate stains from the delicious rogolach. And now, by my lips. And now, maybe, again, the makeup has already come off, whatever the case is. But I still picture myself as I did before, no matter what type of image I apparently see physically before me. And this is exactly what happened to them. They could not relate. They were clearly in a state of shock and denial when they saw themselves for the first time as they truly were. And the Mekoneh knows this as well. This is immediately after the Chorban. We know that Yirmiyahu is going to address the people through the Chorban, and the aftermath of the Chorban, when Nebuzaradan comes and tells him, you can live anywhere in Eretz Yisrael, Yirmiyahu says, but I'm a Navi of the people. I have to join them in Mitzpeh with Gedaliah ben Achikam. And we know that he accompanies them through Rosh Hashanah, through the assassination of Gedaliah, until their way down to Mitzrayim. And therefore, it seems that these keynote were written in the few weeks subsequent to the Chorban, and therefore he knows he cannot address them directly, so instead he personifies Yerushalayim, the third person. Note then that the Kima begins in third person, what's known as Nistar. He speaks about Yerushalayim, but what's very interesting is that by the second half of the Perek, we find the first person. If the people can't relate to Mrs. Goldberg, then because it's too hard for them, so what does the Mekoneh do? He doesn't just tell them, Mrs. Goldberg is going to speak to you, because you ultimately will relive the experiences through observing what has happened to her. He realizes even that's going to be too much for them. So instead he says, behind the curtain over here, there's a Holocaust survivor. And I'd like to tell you what has happened to her. Let me prepare you for the image that you're about to witness. And therefore he begins by telling them what has happened to her. What has happened to Yerushalayim? Maybe you can begin to relate. Maybe you can begin to remember. Maybe you can begin to feel and to leave the state of shock that you're in. Maybe then, once you undergo this stage of shock, maybe then you can get to the next stage. Maybe you can begin to feel. Because once you begin to feel, then you can begin to pick up the pieces and to begin to move on. But he tells us first, this is the woman behind the curtain. Eventually, Mrs. Goldberg is going to appear before us, or Yerushalayim, and she will speak in the first person. Imagine this, by the way. I'm about to introduce to you a Holocaust survivor. Let me tell you what she has gone through. Let me tell you about the horrors. Let me prepare you for this image that you're going to see. Nonetheless, even 13 psukim from now, when you see her coming, what's going to be your reaction? You're still going to gasp, but at least I prepared you properly. And when she comes on, she more or less is going to iterate everything that the Mekoneh has said about her, which corroborates his descriptions and helps us internalize a little bit more. With this, we then are going to start again and try to appreciate what we're supposed to experience through this depiction. Let me tell you something about her. She cries herself to sleep every night, and she has her cheeks soaked with tears. These are fresh tears that you're all going to see. Because what's bothering her? Not because of what actually happened, but because of the aftermath. Because of the post-destruction. There's no one to help her of all of her allies. All of her friends have abandoned her. They've transformed to enemies. Her entire peoples are now in a situation of poverty, she now is going to be immersed within the other nations and is going to be oppressed by them because she hasn't found any manoach, no respite. And her pursuers are catching her, even between the mitzarim, from one mitzar, from one narrow situation to the next, we know Chazal explain, from Shavasar B'Tammuz until Tisha B'Av. Her ways are now ways of mourning. No one is coming to visit her anymore on a moed. Can you imagine? The inbal is empty. No one is coming for the Shalosh Regalim. The same gates that welcomed hundreds and thousands of people for the Shloshet Regalim are now desolate. The Kohanim, who were awaiting the food from the Trumot and the Masrot, they're now sighing. The young maidens are in a state of mourning, and she is embittered. In the meantime, Pasukei, her enemies have become the heads of her pursuers. They have looted her. And why? And note that without any compunction, she says, because God was angry for all of her sins, as her children, as the young ones, went as prisoners before the enemy. And all of her glory has left Zion. Her officers have been like the various deer, Anna, the gazelle, who have left without finding any pasture. And they have gone without strength before their pursuers. Oh, don't worry, she remembers the way she once was. She remembers the way of her youth. She remembers the glory of yore. And now she knows that no one is there to help her. Ra'uat Sarim, her enemies see her. Sachaku al-Mishbataha, they're laughing at her. Chaychata Yerushalayim. It's true. Yerushalayim deserves this because she sinned. But now he says something very harsh. Al-Kain l'nida hayata. And the Parshanim, if you look at the next page, the Parshanim explain, what is this term of nida? She has become minuda. She has become withdrawn. She has become, as Ibn Ezra says, lela'ag, a subject of mockery. Rashi, minuda mimaga kol adam, completely withdrawn from people. Rashi explains as well, she is completely broken, but nida expresses something more. Nida, as we know, connotes not just distance and separation, but withdrawal from the mikdash, in addition from withdrawal from one's husband, a withdrawal from the lover. She is completely alone. She no longer has God, and she no longer has her lover, who here is viewed certainly as HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well, but basically she has no one. She sits in separation, and whether we can control this or not, the other association with Nida is that she's sitting in blood. And even though we know that generally Nida is a temporary status, that she can leave through Tevilah B'Mikveh, in this case, no. She is in a permanent status of abandonment. She is in a state of nida. And let's see how the Mekonein is going to highlight this a little more. Not only is she in nida, all those who once respected her are now mocking her because they see her nakedness. And recognize this. Not only do they see her nakedness, but they see her nakedness in the worst state of her being a nida. How does she respond to this very shameful description? She sighs and she retreats. This is too shameful for her. Her impurity has been ripened, and therefore she can't even remember the days of yore, how once she was so beautiful, because now ein menachem la. And take a look at what happens. And I wonder how many of us are sensitive to this when we actually hear echaz, we sit on the floor on Lil Tisha B'Av. Are you allowing these words to seep through your heart? Are you allowing the poetic devices to evoke some emotional response? Because take a look at what happens in the second half of this pasuk. Re'ei Hashem etzoni ki yigdil oyev. All of a sudden, the third person changes to the first person. What has happened? Yerushalayim, torn, battered, Mrs. Goldberg, what happens to her? She hears the Mekonein describing her and everything that has transpired. She has heard the lamenter describe her shameful status, and she can't take it anymore. So what happens? She comes out from the curtain as if to say, enough, Re'ei Hashem etzoni. Look at me, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is so shameful. Look at my oppression because no one else is looking at me. Re'ei Hashem etzoni ki yigdil oyev. But notice now the next pasuk. What happens? All of a sudden we're back in the third person. It seems as if she looks around and she realizes, oh my, I have burst forth. I couldn't contain my emotion. And therefore she turns to God almost in a frenzy to say, look at me. And then she realizes, uh-oh, right? It's not my turn. One second. I'm going to go back behind the curtain for a moment and let the Mekonein finish. And sure enough, as you'll see, he finishes exactly halfway through the kina, through Pasuk Yud Bet. He continues in Pasuk Yud, Yado Parasar al Kol Machmadaha. The enemy has let out its net on all of her glory, because the Goyim came into the Mikdash, just as we saw that she was just described as a Nida whose Erva should not be revealed. So too, the Goyim came into the Mikdash that they're not allowed to enter. Her entire nation is sighing, and they're asking for bread. And this is what also is intolerable. This is post-destruction, and she literally cannot survive. Not only because people aren't comforting her, people aren't giving her a chance, people aren't coming to say, it's okay, Yerushalayim, you can get up, you can move on, you can rebuild yourself. But not only that, the people are literally starving. How many of you have been to the new Yad Vashem building? I say new, but it's only still about 5 years old. Is it a remarkable, remarkable museum where you go and you travel basically through a tunnel in time, and you begin with the beautiful life in Eastern Europe pre-war, seeing how young children are singing songs of Hatikva, believe it or not, and then you walk in, slowly but surely you see, again, post-World War I, the rise of anti-Semitism in Germany, you see, again, the Nuremberg laws, and then you go through the ghettos. And what's amazing in the ghetto room is that they actually took the cobblestones from the original Lodz ghetto and they brought them to Yad Vashem. So when you're in the ghetto room, you actually feel, and it's a very claustrophobic room, you feel that you're in a ghetto. And there are various transcriptions there on the wall. There is, a page of a diary of someone from the Lodz ghetto who describes how she continued to date her boyfriend in the ghetto, but in order to go to the ghetto theater, they had to walk on the sidewalks where it was full of corpses, and they basically said we would begin to tiptoe over the corpses, but then after a few weeks, they just walked over the corpses, because that's how you walk on the sidewalk in the ghetto. And as you're reading this, you begin to feel, again, what it must have been like to have a transformation of character and perspective when you're living such a life. But to me, the most poignant scene, and some of you may have seen this, is a short video. It's about 10 seconds long, which means that a video of the ghetto that was obviously videoed by a German officer of a young girl, about 5-6 years old, and a young boy, probably about 4 or 5. They seem to be brother and sister, and they're sitting on the sidewalk, and you see some flat bodies behind them, but you also see, again, legs walking to and fro on the sidewalk, which means that the video camera is face to face with these young children. And the young children have their hands out asking for alms, asking for bread, but all you see are feet that are going back and forth. Why isn't anyone giving them any food? There isn't any. But imagine this. This is being videotaped by a German officer. After a few seconds of this, all you see, this is black and white without any voice, you see that the young boy, his head collapses. His head basically falls on his sister's lap. And what does she try to do? She doesn't realize what's going on. She tries to pick him up. Every time she tries to pick him up, what happens? He falls down. What have you just witnessed? You've witnessed the death of starvation of this 4-year-old boy. And then the video ends, and it runs over and over and over again. And not only are you bothered by the fact that you just sat there and you witnessed the death of a 4-year-old boy because of starvation, he was alive a moment ago. But because there was no food, Yerushalayim says, I can't take this. And what's worse is the horror of knowing that there was a German officer videoing this at the entire time, recognizing what was going on, seeing the death that ultimately he's responsible for. This is Pasuk Yud Aleph. The people are sighing, they're asking, they're giving up all of their machamadim, anything that they have for a little bit of food, lashiv nefesh, to restore the life that has been lost. And now at the end of the pasuk, Yerushalayim comes out again. This time she says, it's my turn. Re'e Hashem v'habita ki hayiti zavlela. Hashem, look at me because I've been mocked. I can't take this. Now I'm going to come and I'm going to speak for myself, and I'm going to repeat everything that the Mekonein said about me, and now all of you can relate to what I'm saying because I really represent you. Lo alechem kol ovri derech. I hope, my passersby, that you never have to go through what I went through. Uru'u em yesh machov kemachovi, because has anyone experienced the pain that I have? Asher olali, that has been placed upon me, that I have been oppressed by. Asher hogashem yom charonapo. Has anyone been a victim of God's wrath as much as I have? Mi marom shalach ish bat motai. Do you know what God has done? He has sent out fire in my bones, vayirdena, until I collapsed. Paras reshek l'reglai. Here you're supposed to hear the alliteration, knowing how difficult this is, especially for an Israeli race speaker, right? To say this phrase, paras reshek l'reglai. It's difficult, even on the tongue and on the throat. God has cast out a net to my feet that has trapped me. Nitanani shomema. He has placed me as desolate. Kol hayom dava. I'm miserable all day. Niskar ob sha'ai biado yiskagu alu al tivari. He placed burdens on my neck. Hechshil kochi. He weakened me. Nitanani adonai bidei lo hakum. God placed me in a situation where I simply cannot get up again. Sila kol abirai adonai berkebi kara alai moed. He once again declared a day, but not a festival for me, but a date wherein all of my strong men are going to be broken. He placed me as a gat, as a wine press. He pressed himself upon me, liptulat bat Yehuda. And notice the next pasuk. We reach the end of this kina, al ele ani bochia. This is what I cry for. And you picture her because the Mekonin has already told us in Pasuk Bet, Bachotifke Balaila Vedematal Lachia, I'm warning you, you're going to see her cry. And sure enough, she came out now, and in first person, what's happening to her? She's crying. And this is what she says. This is what I'm crying for. Look at me. Al Ele Ani Bochia in the present. This is what I'm crying for. Eni, Eni Yordamayim. My eyes are simply flowing with tears. Kirachak mimeni menachem. Because there's no one to comfort me. Meshiv nafshi, no one to give me that spirit to move on. Hayu banai shomimim. My children are gone, kigavar oyev. And then something very strange happens in the next pasuk. Here we're finally speaking or hearing the first person speaker. And what happens in pasuk Yitzayin? We go back to third person. And this may sound very technical for some of you, but this is poetry at its best. This is literally the sounds of music. Echa may sound like a harsh word. It's a cry. But it literally is a sounds of music, a very harsh music, a very depressing music, a music that is supposed to pull at those harp strings so that you will cry together with Yerushalayim. All of a sudden, the Mekonein takes over in third person. Look at her! Persatzion biadaha! Her hands are outstretched towards you! Why are her hands outstretched? Because no voice is coming from her. Ein menachem la! And we're asking ourselves, what is the Mekonein doing? Is he trying to get his pasuk back that she took from him? But no. We understand, why can't she say this pasuk? Because she's crying. And here I would like to allude to the film Sounds of Music. How many of you have seen it? Just making sure. Otherwise, I would give you this as an assignment. Do you remember the last scene when Compton Van Trapp takes his guitar and he starts to sing Edelweiss? And this is his beautiful Austria that he is singing to. And he's picturing how beautiful Austria, as he looks at his audience and his friends and his comrades that he has sacrificed his life for in wars for Austria. He then takes a look at the SS officers in the first few rows, and he's recognized how this isn't the Austria that he loves. And he starts to cry. He starts to cry when he thinks of what once was, of his beautiful past and the past of his country, and the present and the very clear, horrific future. Anna, his eyes start welling up with tears. Anna, the words can no longer come out of his throat. And what happens at that point, who remembers? Maria comes out from the back. Do you remember this? I'm going to cry when I think of this scene. And she comes down, she puts her hands on Anna, Captain Van Trapp's shoulders, and she continues to sing Edelweiss with him. And then the children slowly but surely come out to help him express the words that he can no longer express. And this is what we find here beautifully in this kina. Yerushalayim literally is crying. She's crying representing the people who should cry. And she can't say the next pasuk, because her throat is choked up with tears. And what is the pasuk that she can't say? Tziva Hashem le'akos vivav tzarav hayta Yerushalayim l'nida b'nehem. Guilt she can express. Chayv chata Yerushalayim. Ru'u machovi. She can take a look at her guilt. She can see what has transpired. She is very clear. She is cognizant of the phenomena that have occurred around her and how she's been oppressed. But she can't speak about herself as a nida. Because psychologists tell us that there's a difference between an expression of guilt, which is objective, and expression of shame. We can't say really of ourselves, I am shamed. Someone can say, you should be ashamed of yourself. I can say I am guilty. But shame, the shame of a nida, is too hard to express. And that's why the Mekomin says it for her. But then she takes over the last few psukim, Tzadik Hashem, Kipi Umariti. God is right. All the nations have heard what has happened. Ure'u machovi, look at my pain. Betulatayu bacharai halchu bashavi. Look at how my children have gone off as prisoners. I called to my lovers, but they have tricked me. The older ones in the city are now dying because they're asking for a little bit of a morsel of bread to keep themselves alive. Re'e Hashem kitzarli. Hashem, look. Look at my pain. I'm sick in the stomach. There is death surrounding me, outside, inside. And one last time, because no one is reaching out to my hands. How many of you have sat in front of an avel and you haven't said anything, but you've held that avel's hands? Has that helped? Of course. This, as we know, is not simply a cry for vengeance that every kina ends with, but rather, the next pasuk as well, is a cry for justice. Hashem, this is just too much. I can't handle this. And now let me ask you, as we end today, what is it that the Mekonen is trying to elicit from his audience? What does he want from this generation that's now in shock? In shock and depression and weary and lonely and abandoned from everything that they've experienced. What does he want them to do? He wants them to see themselves, but that's too hard for them. So he wants them to look at Yerushalayim, look at her, look at her cry. And what is he hoping that will happen to each and every one of us? What is he hoping that will happen to his generation as they see Yerushalayim crying before them? What should happen to them? You should cry. He wants them to cry, to shed a tear. Because if you can shed a tear over Yerushalayim, then I know that you feel something again. And if you begin to feel, then I know that you can begin to pick up your lives. Then I know that you can begin to turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Shuvah. But notice now at the end of Kina Aleph, was he successful? Apparently not. Because he composes Kina Bet. And this is not the subject of our shiur today, but if you look in Kina Bet, you'll see that it is full of words of anger. Each verb, bila, she made, haras, dikair. He talks about the anger. He says, look at what has happened to Yerushalayim. How God let out his wrath. Look at how women were consuming their children. What does he want his audience to feel now? If you couldn't respond to your shock and denial with tears, then what's the next stage? Anger. Then turn to God with anger. And is it okay, by the way, to turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in anger? Well, see Eo, see Yirmiyahu, see Moshe Rabbeinu. Well, of course you can. Turn to God with anger because it's better than not turning to God at all. And he's begging them, pick yourselves up. Start to now fix that rift that you created between yourselves and God. If you can't cry, then at least turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in anger. Does that work? Apparently not. He tries again, Kina Gimel. He says, Ani HaGiver. He says, okay, forget about Yerushalayim. Apparently, this poetic device is not working. I'm trying to personify you through Yerushalayim so that you can relate to her without being in complete denial. But instead, look at me. I'm one of you. I'm a microcosm of the Churban. And anyone who's learned Sefer Yirmiyahu with his various 9 lives of survival knows that this is true. He says, I know what it's like. I have felt like the bullseye of God. Do you know that I have tried to cry out to God, and I feel that God has placed a mechitza against me. That God has targeted himself as if he's trying to hunt me like a bear. He says, I know what it's like to have your flesh torn off of your skin. And for those familiar with Sefer Yirmiyahu, he was placed on a mahapechet, on a torture wheel. Indeed, he knows what this is like. And he says, so look at me. I was at the stage where I kept telling myself, tomorrow's going to be better, tomorrow's going to be better. But what happened? The next day was worse and worse. And I reached a state where I decided I don't have any faith in God. He says, but then I realized, Hashem kilo tamnu kilo chalu rachamav. One day I was walking in my danik without any feet on my swollen, without any shoes on my swollen feet, and I saw a ray of sunlight between the clouds seeping through the trees. And I realized, you know what? There is chesed. God does express himself in kindness, even if I don't see it now. And that's what gave me hope to think that maybe I can go on. And maybe one day I will be the subject of that kindness.
And therefore he turns to the people and he says, so relate to me as I relate to you. Nach besad racheno v'nachkora v'nashuva at Hashem. He transforms the personal experience into Lashon Rabbim, into the national experience, and he says, let's try this together. We've all undergone a terrible Shoah. We've all undergone torture. We've all now, we're the survivors of the Khorban. Let us pick the pieces together and move on and turn towards Hashem together. Does that work? No, we have to go on to Parag Dalet, where we see again the anger. Come on, just scream out again. But now he says something worse. He doesn't just talk about mothers consuming their children. He talks about Yidei Nashim Rachmaniyot Bishluet Yadan. He says, now it's your fault. Because now that you aren't picking up the pieces, what has happened to your moral state? You have a completely deteriorated. Now women who were once merciful, moral, ethical people, they are now consuming their children. Can you imagine this? And you're supposed to be addressing the people, trying to tell them, this is the unimaginable. God put you in this situation, but look at how you're responding. There are blind people walking around with their hands full of blood, but they don't even recognize it because they're blind. Look how terrible the situation is. And he's hoping that maybe if they recognize their own ethical deterioration, maybe then they'll start to pick themselves up and again turn to God. But he gives up after four keynotes. And he realizes that this is a generation that's not responding. They are entirely apathetic. They are indifferent to all of his overtures of crying, of being angry, of turning to Hashem with tshuva, with the personal and national. And then he finally says, Hashem, Zachor Hashem, God, I give up on these people. So God, I'm begging you. You are the one who's going to be around forever. Lama lanetzach tishkachenu. Don't forget about us. Because if you leave us in this sorry state, then that's exactly where we're going to stay. We are not going to respond. Hashem, I hate to tell you this, but this generation has experienced so much of your wrath, so much fury, so much oppression, that they don't know how to respond. This is the generation of the silent survivors. They don't even know how to express themselves at HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So I beg of you, if there's ever going to be a revival of a relationship, Hashem, it's not going to come from us. Hashivei nu Hashem Eilacha v'nashuva. Yirmiyahu begs Hashem, I know the formula in Devarim Perek Lamed. I know what all the Nevi'im say. How does it work? We're the ones who cause the rift between ourselves and God, and therefore we're the ones who have to somehow fix what we cause. We're the ones who have to initiate returning to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Shuvu Eilai v'ashuva Eilichem. But Yirmiyahu says, Hashem, can you please do us a favor? Hashivei nu, can you return to us? Because chances are, we're not going to return to you. If you return to us, and then the hope is, v'nashuva, that we will then return to you. You take the first step, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because we're not. I always say this is one of the top 10 songs, and unfortunately sometimes it's taken out of context as we sing it in a happy tune. Is this a happy song? I like the slow tune much better. Because it depicts Hashiveinu. This is a de facto request or almost a begging of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem, please turn to us because we're not crying, because we're not shouting, because we're not repenting, because we haven't reached the resolve that things are so bad that there's only one way to move on, and that is by turning to you. So Hashem, instead, you turn to us. The hope is that every Tisha B'Av, when we sit on the floor and when we listen to this, we're not just supposed to listen. And as we said, as a Megillah, we're supposed to probe. We're supposed to sensitize ourselves. Every year, we hear of the Konein saying, look, eini your damayim. And what should happen to every single one of us in 3.5 weeks? By the end of Kina Aleph, we should all be crying. Because if we're not crying, then we're doing something wrong. Then we are just as apathetic as the generation of the Khorban. Just shed one tear. I don't get up from the ground until I know that I've cried. And sometimes it means looking at pictures of children in the Shoah. And sometimes it means just trying to picture Har HaBayit Shomem, trying to picture Ganelachan going up to Har HaBayit, Arab children playing soccer. Again, in the area of the Chatzar Beit Hashem. Again, picture this and cry. Shed a tear. Because if you can shed a tear, that means that you're beginning to respond. That you feel something. And hopefully that feeling will lead us to turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But if that doesn't work, it's okay. There's another kina coming up. And that kina is supposed to arouse anger. Be angry at God. Turn to God, at least with your screams, with your shouts. Because if not, then beware of the triple acrostic in Perikimol. Then you're going to have to hear that really long kina of Ani HaGiver. You're going to have to hear the Mekonen sharing with us his personal experiences of torture. You're going to have to hear him saying, come on, Nach Besad Racheinu V'Nach Korah V'Nashuva Ad Hashem. Maybe by relating to his personal experience, you'll be able on a national level to respond and to turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Shuva. But if not, you're going to have to hear Perek Dalid, which is really a sickening kina, which is when you get to hear about how people are so indifferent to the changes, to the transformations of their own character post-Korban. How because they didn't respond, that doesn't mean that they stay static, but instead deteriorated in their own character. But worst of all, if you don't respond after Kina Dalid, then you're going to have to hear the Mekonen giving up on you, giving up on me, giving up on all of us. Then we're going to have to hear Zechor Hashem. Then we have to stand and sit as witnesses when the Mekonen says, there's no hope for them, this generation is gone. And Hashem, please at least don't give up on us for the future. And please then you return to us, because it seems as if we're not going to return to you. The hope is that this Tisha B'Av, understanding the keynote a little more, being a little more sensitive to the sounds of music, to the beautiful and horrific poetry that's employed here, that we should cry after Kina Aleph, that we should be angry after Kina Bet, that we should turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Shuva, so that we don't finish Eicha this year. And Be'ezrat Hashem, if the sounds of music pull the proper harp strings, then we'll all be able to sing the Shirei Tehillim on Har HaBayit.
No, that's fine. Thank you so much, Shani, for your beautiful and powerful words of Torah. You could probably just take maybe one or two questions.
I always say this isn't the typical shiur where one is engaged in intellectual study and trying to interpret or and to appreciate a text more. I always say this time it's very difficult to ask questions. Again, to a speaker. Ultimately, we're supposed to ask the questions to ourselves. Nonetheless,
I'm not going to ask a question, but I just want to make two comments.
Please.
The difference between Suvim and Levium. There was a view that you're not allowed to put Suvim written properly on Levium. The Prime Minister was against that view. He said the Kedusha of both of them are equal. The only difference is that the Diyum were originally given to be spoken, to be addressed to Israel, then written. But Ksuvim was originally given to be written and not spoken. So that's the difference for your time between the Diyum and Ksuvim. With respect to Simchas Kalah, the Rambam in Hilchos Eivel, when he discusses Vahata L'Reyata Kavocha, in the manuscripts, the reading is Mitzvah L'Sameach Chosan V'Chala.
Very interesting.
In the printed edition, it's reversed, but I checked the manuscript readings, and it's Chosan V'Chala.
See that?
So, the mitzvah is equal.
It's also for the chassan who's experiencing some reservation. Yes, then, oh, beautiful. But I think that why is it that in the printed edition, it's primarily kala? Because everywhere else it appears only as simchat kala. I was just going to say, Maimonides was egalitarian. That's right. Yes, then, oh, beautiful. And Rav Chaim Mibrisk's distinction is discussed, believe it or not, by Ibn Ezra as well.
Except the function was different.
Beautiful.
The Levium was originally, and there's an interesting point. I once asked Professor Shalom Paul in Yerushalayim, can you imagine on this world listening to that literary Hebrew of Yirmiyahu and the Levium and understanding exactly what the Navi had in mind?
That's funny.
Because we're having difficulty understanding sometimes the message.
Right, that's why we definitely have to re-engage in the study of Nevi'im. For those who know me, this is a little pet peeve of mine, and to make sure that we learn the Torah properly.
I used that with Abu Israel, and they understood exactly what the Zohar had in mind.
Yes, even if they didn't always respond.
Was like whistling to the wind.
That's right, exactly. They were sensitive, even though, unfortunately, they didn't respond. Interestingly, Ibn Ezra of Rasadi Gaon, they debate also about the distinction between Nevi'im and Ketuvim, meaning this is a much larger topic, because we see that there are so many both personalities that apparently are both authors of Nevi'im and Ketuvim, Sefer Daniel, which poses its own problems of our histories, really Ruach Nevuah or Ruach HaKodesh. So again, certainly one distinction in terms of the methodology, whether it was meant to be written or meant to be said, but there are others who explain that really the level is different.
Yes.
So a machloket.
That's
great.
You ended up with the pasuk,
thank you.
But that is not really the last.
Beautiful.
That is not the last pasuk of the chapter. The actual end of the chapter is a very hopeless note of Ki'im and so on, and that Chazal is one of four biblical books where the last pasuk is very negative, and they instead instituted the custom, which we follow to this day, of repeating the next to the last verse, which is a more hopeful note.
Beautiful. So I'm so happy you said that. Again, when do Chazal institute this? Chazal say that anytime we read a Megillah, which means that we're reading something aloud in a public forum, we don't end on a sour note. But notice again, the Kina, just as you said, ends with Ki'im Os Masano Katafta Leino Amon. Hashem, it's just not fair. You were too angry with us. You were too disgusted with us. That's his personal expression. But Chazal say that is so disheartening to leave like that. Let's go back to the pseudo-disheartening pasuk, not as bad, of Hashiveinu Hashem Elecha V'Nashuva. So beautifully said. And that's why the makorot that appear thereafter on the last page are really the makorot that show us not only how Yirmiyahu reverses Devarim Perek Lamed of Vishafta, but ultimately the famous midrash in Echa of, again, Rabbi Akiva, the idea of, again, Nachamuni, Nachamuni, Ani Menachamecha, that ultimately Hashem, we ask Hashem also in the Haftarah of Nachamu, Nachamu, Ami, we say, Hashem, we need to be comforted by you. And Hashem answers us, yes, but I also need to be comforted by you. So with this symbiotic relationship that we're supposed to feel by the end of Echa, that should encourage us not to wait for Hashem to initiate, but hopefully inspire us to initiate. But thank you for drawing attention to the double ending, which is only when you read it out loud, which means that if you read Echa to yourselves, how are you going to end? On the very negative note of Pasuk Chaf Bet. But when we read it as a Megillah, meaning in a public forum, so we're supposed to leave with a little bit of inspiration.
Now that you mentioned that, not only do we ask Hashem to comfort us, we have to comfort him. The Midrashim and Midrash Echa Ramati, expand greatly on the role of Hashem.
Exactly. That's right. Again, so, which is to transform Echa into a work of comfort instead of just a work of a listening or response from us.
I think in the interest of time, I'm sorry.
I'd like to piggyback. Even
the Torah, you're not permitted to conclude a reading with the Harav. That's right. Again, in the Tochacha, again, we have various cases of this. Beautiful.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to end. I don't want to volunteer.
People
to
can come up, that's right.
I'm sorry, before we end, just two things. First of all, I want to thank everybody again for a really wonderful year. We'll see you back in the fall. Beth would like to talk to you for a couple minutes about Tehillah.
I just want to remind everyone that the Women's Summer Learning Program, Tehillah, is starting this Wednesday. Unfortunately for you men who are here, it's only for women. But we have a very exciting lineup. We have 9 different teachers, and some of them, they range from teaching for 2 weeks to 5 weeks. We're starting out.